Hi, this is Paul. Lots of videos this week. Yesterday, I posted a video on how I've seen so many people come to me who had suffered from depression, and they have told me that watching Jordan Peterson videos lifted their depression in a significant, nearly, or not merely, nearly a miraculous way. And this is something I'm continuing to ponder. I began to notice, having many conversations, how many people came to me and had told me about their depression. And of course, this is a piece of Peterson. And someone put in the comment section, if you having a YouTube channel is about the best learning community you can find, I think, because I learn way more from the channel than I think I teach in it. So let's talk more about meaning and depression. Why does listening to Jordan Peterson videos heal depression in some, but especially men? And that's also very interesting. Not everybody, obviously, not everybody who listens to Peterson has depression, but there's got to be something about the salience of listening to Peterson for people with depression. I suspect there's something going on there too. Now remember, meaning is Peterson's sacrament. And if you've been following my conversation, you know I'm working on fleshing out and understanding what sacrament is. And actually, I think figuring out sacrament is key to trying to figure out the role, what caused the Protestant Reformation, the role the Protestant Reformation played, the timing of the Protestant Reformation in history, and the ways that the Protestant Reformation played in terms of the development of science and secularity in the West. All of this stuff is tied together, and I think it's also tied in with the meaning crisis, and that is why meaning is Jordan Peterson's sacrament. Now Strawn said responsibility, but the more I think about this, they're connected, but I think it's meaning. The biblical series was especially potent in this. Many of the people I talked to, again, part of this is selection, people who are going to be connecting with my channel and the certain aspects of Peterson that I'm working on, they will be drawn to the biblical series, and so many of us are want to see him get back to it and please do more. But instead, he's doing the his book tour, which, again, in terms of the drug he needs for his own meaning crisis and his own depression, I can easily see why the book tour for him is so fulfilling. Now, Jack Hayes, I did a conversation with him that'll be that's it's about my next conversation that I'm posting, but I'm putting out so many videos of mine this week, it got a little bumped, but I'll probably put that conversation out next week and the next 2 weeks, actually a whole month of May, I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling, so I don't know how many videos I'm going to be able to put out. So those of you who are, crying uncle in terms of the amount of stuff I'm putting out now, well, get ready for a little drought because it may come. But then again, you know how that goes with vacation. So, pointed to me that that's something that should have been obvious to me. The Rebel Wisdom Jordan Peterson compilation had Tim Lott on it, and Tim Lott said something important. Now, Lott is a journalist, and he has done some of the best interviews with Peterson, some of the videos that we tend to return to again and again and again. He was the one that asked Peterson if he was a Christian. Now, that was where you catch someone in their story arc is really important, and Lott's timing was perfect in terms of Peterson was he had just reached liftoff, but he hadn't really reached the stratosphere yet. And so he caught Peterson at just the right time. And in that video, Peterson is sitting there like in an undershirt and talking, not the nice suit, like an undershirt. And Lot asks him about the resurrection and asks him if he identifies with a Christian. And Lot goes straight to it. And then Lot does a much more significant, not more, but a longer interview then with Rebel Wisdom, where they talk about the left and a bunch of those issues. But then per Rebel Wisdom's, and I've been noticing that with their interviews, he usually circles back and asks them about Jordan Peterson. And David Fuller's a pretty smart guy, and he's setting up his he's setting up his material. This is what the guy does for a living. And so now he has a Jordan Peterson Rebel Wisdom compilation video of Peterson. And Tim Lott has a short segment in it, but it's really important for this discussion that I'm having.
The most important thing for me, quite apart from his work with, you know, these stories of modern myths, was, as you say, his investigation into the Bible. And I've always been fascinated, although I'm an atheist, I've always been fascinated by the power of the biblical stories. I often found myself looking at these huge cathedrals and churches that sprouted up all over Europe, you know, and...
You know, even... last night I was up a little late and giving Adam some grief on Twitter. You know, even on Amun Ra, which... Even he goes into a cathedral, even right after saying there's no good to religion at all, even he goes into cathedral and can't not be impressed. And now Tim Lott's point here is considerably more honest and, I would say, frankly, rational.
...of the biblical stories. I often found myself looking at these huge cathedrals and churches that sprouted up all over Europe, you know, and I asked myself, well, what's that about? You know, why was this story so powerful? I mean, yeah, it's a defense against death, if you want to be cynical, but hey, you know, it could be lots of other stories, you know, and why is this one so unbelievably powerful? And what does it mean for it to be so powerful? And Peterson, I think, brilliantly answers that question in the biblical lectures he's done. And he really changed me, those lectures. He genuinely did, I think, change the way I lived my life.
See, and this is what I keep hearing from people. This is what I talk to people a lot about Peterson, and this is what I keep hearing from people. And Tim Lott, he's a little older than most, but he fits the profile. So he's a harbinger, he's a forerunner.
So unbelievably powerful. And what does it mean for it to be so powerful? And Peterson, I think, brilliantly answers that question in the biblical lectures he's done. And he really changed me, those lectures. He genuinely did, I think, change the way I lived my life, because he came to this very, very important conclusion, which I'm pretty convinced by. I don't think I'm ever 100% convinced by anything, but I'm very convinced by his idea, as I'm someone who's suffered depression, and depression is like a crisis of meaning in your it's the worst thing about...
There it is. Depression, at least. See, and notice what we've done to depression. We've medicalized it. Well, it's a brain imbalance. It's has nothing to do with my environment. It's only in my brain. And I go back to Jung's autobiography. Jung is a young medical student. He's working in a psychiatric hospital. And all of the other doctors tell Jung, don't talk to the patients. Don't waste your time. They're crazy. And Jung's kind of like, yeah, but isn't that why we're here, to help the crazy? So he starts talking to the patients and he begins to, you know, listen to Verveke, he begins to see patterns. And he begins to say, why is it that the crazy dreams of the medical patients line up with, the stories in their lives? What is it about the story out there and the story in here and how this all comes together that might manifest itself in dysfunction? Because if you're locked up in a mental hospital at the beginning of the 20th century, there's some real dysfunction going on, probably. Is it dysfunction? Is there perhaps a way to address the dysfunction by addressing the storytelling? And if you look at the whole development of modern psychology, one whole aspect of modern psychology is addressing the dysfunction inside by addressing the story outside and working the interface between the story outside and the story inside. Now, as a pastor, I can very much recognize this, because obviously pastoral care is far older than modern psychology, but that is exactly what pastoral care does. We take the story of the Bible and the story inside and we work them together. Okay. Now, a little bit later in this video, we're going to have to talk about, in some ways, why the church lost its way and how the church lost its way. And if someone in the church is unable to talk about the way the church has lost their way, in my opinion, that is evidence of corruption. Because Again, I'm a Calvinist. One of the convenient things about Calvinism is you never lose points if you talk about failure. Failure in the church, failure in myself. That's part of the total depravity. It's the big first T in tulip, baby. So that's what Calvinists are good at. So you've got the story out there, and you've got the story in here, and Jung points out that there's progress to be made in that. And if you look at the bit from Jung's autobiography that I had in a couple videos ago, where he and Freud really came to disagreement, and Jung Jung thought that Freud's positivism, his ardent atheism, and his ardent atheism was impeding Freud from actually helping him work with his patients. Now, of course, Jung goes hard the other direction. But the basic point that the story out there and the story in here makes perfect sense, given the fact that, as Verveke mentions early on in the Benjamin Boyce, well, at one point in the Benjamin Boyce conversation, story is the primary way of working through these things. Okay, we are stories. And again, you look at that you look at the Friended conversation, the Think Club conversation with Amun-Ra. You know, I just, boy, that's the problem when I watch some of those videos is that I begin to think in very unchristian, unkind ways. But I'll try to hold myself back. You know, the guy said, "Well, I can't stand stories." Oh yeah, but you are a story, and what an interesting story you are, dude. I'm sorry, I just. Yeah, get that video out of my mind. It was just too much fun. Anyway, the story out there and the story here, and the big story, and of course, it's not just analytically the story I tell myself, because a lot of the story, these stories regulate our emotions. That's a big part of Jordan Peterson's point about, you know, you don't poke people in their axioms, they get upset. Well, our emotions and the regulations of our emotions have everything to do with our story, which is, again, part of the reason why the church has been, and religion in general, Adam, has been so enormously successful in not only helping communities stabilize and mobilize, but also individuals stabilize and mobilize, because perhaps one of the best ways for us to maintain emotional equilibrium and emotional, what's the best word? It's not just equilibrium, emotional health. One of the best ways for us to maintain emotional health is to continue, we're continually working on the story out there and the story in here, okay? And so when we see depression and it's depression and anxiety skyrocketing at the same time that the nuns, and not N-U-N-S, but N-O-N-S-E, as the same time people are walking away from established religions, they're not necessarily becoming less religious, they're just heading out alone in their religious pilgrimage. In other words, again, back to Adam keeps saying we don't understand his take on morality. I think maybe Adam and I'll have to have another conversation. I think I have some understanding on his take of morality, but when it comes to story, people are not meant to be alone. We are enormously cooperative, and Adam gets that right away. We are enormously cooperative. But this goes beyond just kind of this pragmatic externalized vision of how we are able to maintain ourselves. This has everything to do with how we see ourselves, the stories we inhabit, the people we are with. This is one whole thing. And so this entire process of the interface between the story out there and the story in here is deeply crucial to our emotional well-being and the rest of our consciousness congress. Will tell us that there are problems first in terms of our emotions. And depression and anxiety are going to be the canaries in the coal mine. Okay, so it is no accident then that the receding of communal religion, and again, now a lot of the nun, nonesses, a lot of the nuns are, they're not less religious, they're just doing it by themselves. Okay, now they're looking for their religion in Netflix, and they're looking for their religion in social media, and they're looking for their religion in Star Wars and Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings. But that's very different from finding your religion in the real community that, in fact, has familial relationships and all of these things all around you. And I think Adam, though he be an atheist, can appreciate the consequence of this reality. And that this gets manifest in depression and anxiety is very reasonable. And that as Peterson revivifies the Bible, and as, you know, and this again is why I started meetups, as once people start talking to Peterson, and I've heard this not just from people directly to me, not just from people online, but other individuals who are actually trying to develop institutions and things in real life. Somebody was in a Jordan Peterson, someone was in a Jordan P someone was in a Jordan Peterson book tour thing, and this person who I've been talking to for quite a while now, here's the person behind him say something to the effect of, "Wow, but who can I talk about this with?" You're missing church. You're haunted by this. It's the nuns have walked away from what might make them healthy. Now again, I'm not trying to establish some. There's plenty of depressed people in church, and you know, I as a pastor know that, and the shortcomings of church I certainly know. But you walking away from it didn't necessarily help your cause. Well, some would say, well, it really helped me. Oh, fine. I mean, your mileage may vary. I get that. But what I'm trying to establish and trying to figure out is this link between the broad social changes, the broad walking away from organized, familially bonded religion, and the rise of anxiety and depression. And now these things work very slowly, they work multi-generationally. And so the more I think about this, the more sense it makes to me. Okay, let's get back to Tim Lott.
About depression. I'm very convinced by his idea, because
Yeah?
I'm someone who's suffered depression.
Whenever I have interruptions in my conversations, people are like, "Well, you should put a sign on your door." And I tell them, I said, "You know, sign on the door won't make any difference because I got a sign on that door." And folks, "Pastor Paul, Pastor Paul." Yeah. Okay, where were we? Back to Tim Lott.
Crisis of, as I'm someone who's suffered depression. And depression is like a crisis of meaning in your and it's the worst thing about depression is not about being miserable, it's being having a life that seems utterly meaningless, and that's why it's such torment. And Peterson, in a way, tries to answer the question, how do we as an individual, that's a bit of a paradox, how do I as an individual,
No, you're right the first time. How do we as an individual? That's exactly right, and that's why what's happening is happening.
in a way, tries to answer the question, how do we as an individual, that's a bit of a paradox, how do I as an individual acquire meaning? Because meaning is the most important thing any of us could have. You know, there's
Meaning is the most important any of us could have. It's a sacrament. Okay? The Church of Peterson, the sacrament is meaning. Now, responsibility is coming to the table for the sacrament, but the sacrament is meaning because it is the body and blood.
acquire meaning. That's a bit of a paradox. How do I, as an individual, acquire meaning? Because meaning is the most important thing any of us could have. You know, there's meaning is it. You know, if you don't know, and yet no one can quite say what meaning is, which I think is interesting in itself. You know,
Again, the Protestant Reformation fought over this is my body. What the meaning of is. It's what the Protestant Reformation, in many ways, if you want to boil it down to one thing, what the meaning of is the Protestant Reformation.
Everyone could have. You know, there's meaning is it. You know, if you don't, and yet no one can quite say what meaning is, which I think is interesting in itself. You know, everyone says, well, I want a sense of meaning. Well, what is a sense of meaning? What is meaning? And Peterson, I think, acknowledges that mystery, but also says, well, you know, if you want a sense of meaning, it's not about just doing what you want. It's not about just following your bliss, as Joseph Campbell would be, or having as much fun as possible, or...
And it's not about just doing what you want. And now, in our age, we can do so much more than we ever could before. You know, when I was growing up, what kids in high school, if you were growing up in high school in New Jersey where I was, if you were one of those elites that went to Florida on spring break, that was pretty upper class. If you got to go to Florida for spring break, most of us just had New Jersey spring. Now people in high school, they're going on mission trips around the world, and there's so much more. When I was growing up, if you wanted to watch a movie, you had to go to a movie theater, and then VHS came out, and there was, in college, it was this amazing box, and you could go to Blockbuster and rent a movie and play it in your VHS, and it was just like, boom. Now you turn on Netflix, and whoosh. How many movies on Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and on and on and on and on? And that doesn't do a thing with meaning. It's like it dulls it, or we're distracted from it, but beneath, we're still there. And in fact, it seems the more stuff and clutter and distraction we have, the meaninglessness grows. What's with that? We don't know it, but you know, this is what's happening.
Or even a sense of meaning. It's not about just doing what you want. It's not about just following your bliss, as Joseph Campbell would be, or having as much fun as possible, or even necessarily being
happy.
No, absolutely not necessarily being happy. There are more important things than being happy. And I've also found that to be true in my life.
More important. Well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by more important? You mean... it's up the hierarchy. There are things higher in the hierarchy than happiness. You will exchange for, if you're looking for meaning, you will suffer. You will sacrifice happiness. You will sacrifice good things. In fact, get into Jordan Peterson and sacrifice itself. And we're going to get into that because I'm going to play a little bit more of the Peterson-Sam Harris debate, because it's been a few months since we've played that. So it's a good thing to replay. But Lot is exactly right. He's exactly right here. And so you've got this crisis of anxiety and meaning. And recently, Pew Research, share of U.S. teens who see as the major problem among their peers, anxiety and depression, 70%. Listen to Jonathan Haidt on Joe Rogan talk about cutting and anxiety among teenagers. 70%, bullying, 55%. That's in a sense, and listen again to Jonathan Haidt and Joe Rogan on that one, too. Drug addiction, drinking alcohol, poverty, teen pregnancy, gangs. And just look at the scale. You know, 70% called it a major problem. 26% called it a minor problem. Only 4% said it isn't a problem. 4%. I mean, this is enormous. And once you start seeing it, And once you, you know, so then I've got the sample question. Okay, why mostly men? And then why the most, generally speaking, why the people watching my channel, why is it that so many of the people, now if you're going to be the one to dig up my email address and send me an email and say, you know, I really want to talk to you, and then I'll send you the link for the conversation and so on and so forth. If you're that motivated to talk to me, well, you're probably up there in the hierarchy of everyone listening to me. And why so many people that contact and seek me out have been struggling with anxiety and depression? And it's like, well, of course, you know, why, you know, you're going to look for this kid if you're dead and you've got to say something to the living. This is what's happening. Now, what about Jordan Peterson's application? Well, let's not forget that, and this is something that we might forget in terms of watching my channel when I talk about the shortcomings of the church. Let's not forget that there are billions of people already using the Bible. Okay? Billions of people using the Bible at one level or another. Maybe not successfully, maybe not well, maybe not very often. Nominally, billions of people are Christians. All right? Hundreds of millions of people are using it at a much higher level. All right. And so people are already using the Bible to medicate their anxiety and their depression and their secularity. That's already happening. In fact, even though Jordan Peterson might look like a big deal, he's small potatoes compared to the church. And as I mentioned before, Billy Graham used to fill stadiums. All right. Now, it would be very interesting to have Jordan Peterson. He's been like 3,000-5,000 men, you know, venues. I won't tell you what I think of Joel Osteen, but Jordan Peterson compared to Joel Osteen, he fills that, or he at least puts a lot of people in the seats every week where I think it's the Houston Rockets used to play in Houston. I mean, that's a big draw. And hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions, see him on Sunday morning TV every Sunday. And if you've ever watched Joel Osteen, they begin. They begin by saying their little Pledge of Allegiance to the Bible. And then, quite frankly, they quickly forget it. There, I'll get it out. So Peterson is comparatively small. That's important for us to remember. But Peterson has been particularly effective with a population deeply impacted by the New Atheists. And remember, the New Atheists rose to prominence in the wake of 9/11. And again, one of the really good videos out there about Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris is Mouthy Buddha's. Is Sam Harris losing his audience to Jordan Peterson? And Mouthy Buddha, I think, did that in March last year. That was a year ago. And he sensed it then, and I, you know, watched the video. It's a really good video. Well, why Jordan Peterson? Well, Doctor, heal thyself. Node did a little video following up on a video that I had done, and Node and I tend to kind of go back and forth, and I love how Node goes deep dives into some of this stuff. Jordan Peterson has long suffered from depression, and he's forthright in that. Some people have asked me about Vox Day's book because of some other people who had bit hard on Jordan Peterson and now either felt spurned by him or rejected by him, or for one reason or another have been making a lot of noise against him. So I didn't want to, after I listened to the Three Creators Symposium, I wasn't at all motivated to look at Vox Day's books, but because some other people were trying to get me into that conversation, I picked up the book and I skimmed through it, and I find almost nothing of value in that book, because most of the book just looks like a lot of cheap shots on Jordan Peterson. And you know, if you want to, they charge him with being a huckster, but I'll tell you, if you want to turn a quick buck, you know, real quick, write a book about Jordan Peterson and put it out there on Amazon, and you'll get $6 from a whole bunch of people and you'll make some money. Okay? I'm not recommending the book. But one of the things that they knock him for is, well, Jordan Peterson is mentally ill, therefore we can't believe him. That's such an offensive take on depression. Some of the smartest people in the world suffer with, you know, struggle with mental illness issues and depression. In fact, it tends to skew with high IQs. That's part of the reason I know I'm not that smart, is because I'm way too happy. But so I don't see how that's a knock on Jordan Peterson. And what he's trying to do is, he's the best people to figure out how to get out of a box is to follow someone who's made it out. And that's very much who he is. His journey began in the conflict of the Cold War. And he fills his home with Soviet-era art. And again, so Vox Dei picks that up, and others have picked that up. And it is a very interesting thing. We are not transparent to ourselves why we select the kinds of things in our lives, especially when it comes to art. We're very complicated that way, but obviously for Peterson, he's working out his own, the words of the Bible, he's working out his own salvation, he's working out his own struggles, he's working out his own stuff with that. Well, why? Well, again, it's all in his story. And then Jung, Piaget, Rogers, these psychologists, the affirmed validation of the religious against the materialistic fashion. And again, Peterson then goes into myth, and he learns this, and he begins to see how throughout history we have regulated ourselves internally by regulating our stories externally. That is not somehow irrational. It is completely rational. You know it's irrational? Taking all kinds of powerful drugs and monkeying around with the chemistry of our brain, and a lot of what passes for dispensing psychological pills. Talk to my friend James about that. A lot of what dispenses for that is trial and error. And as a pastor, I see it all the time. Someone is in trouble in terms of their mental health, and they go to the doctor and they give them a pill. Try this. And they try it for 6 months. Is it helping? Nope. Try this other. And you very quickly get the idea of, I'm not sure they know what they're doing. They're just giving you pills. And what many of these pills, in my opinion, in my non-professional observation, see, most of those pills just kind of level people out, make them a little bit more compliant, a little less chaotic. And part of that's really good, because the chaos was destroying their lives and destroying the people around them, but they exchanged it for kind of a gray death. And I have seen that again and again and again as I have watched people trying to gain sanity. And so this ancient way of regulating the story outside and the story inside. I read this very interesting piece by Scott Alexander a while ago, where he talked about the rates of schizophrenia in immigrants and how the process of immigration seemed to spike schizophrenia and other mental illnesses, that getting us out of our context, not just of our story context, but even of our physical context, disrupts people. And of course, we know this, move a cat, and Peterson will talk about the cat has to explore, move a dog. We will see this with the elderly. They leave, you will watch elderly people, I want to die at home. And they dig their nails into the carpet and say, you're going to pull me out of this house. And then you bring them into a sterile place with white walls and fluorescent tubes. And here, you sit here and die. Oh, well, we call that hell, because the family can't be bothered. This is what's going on. And yes, the story outside and the story inside. And so why not try rationally going the story route towards sanity? And that's what's happening. And I see that's what Peterson is doing. And so you might say, well, drugs couldn't kick your depression, but story is. Is that irrational? Tell me the side effects of story. Well, they can be significant behaviorally, but not chemically, like these powerful things that are flatlining people and putting them into the gray zone. So, you know, this is what's going on. And Peterson is, like you said, he was working through the gray zone and he's working through the antidepressants. And he discovered, and I'm not surprised by this, not only a change in diet, if you listen to the third talk that I did with Job, change in diet can be really effective for people. Exercise can be really effective for people, but also story. It's an amazing, the story cure is not different from the talking cure, because what you're doing when you're talking is you are working on your story. And I listened to that, the one guy about going to Gabor Mate and the psychedelic thing. Well, again, you know, the focus is on the psychedelic, but what he really changed was his story. And well, why should that surprise me as a pastor? It doesn't at all, because this is what pastors have been doing for centuries. We're changing people's stories that they're inhabiting and living in. And wouldn't you know it, if they live in a better story, they live better lives. I guess I got triggered. So Jung and Piaget and Rogers affirmed the validity of the religious against the materialist fashion, and he himself is drawn to the Bible. Okay? And he wanted to talk to Sam Harris. Now, Jonathan Peugeot, after those talks, and I think it was a question and answer in another video, Jonathan was talking about, why Sam Harris? Why Sam Harris? Well, if you think in these terms, Sam Harris is your next stop. Sam Harris is, you know, Peterson, in a sense, he's beyond Sam Harris. And those following Peterson are walking over Sam Harris. And Sam is like, no, story is irrational. And everyone's saying, I don't give a rat's tail about your pride over rationality. I want to live. And you weren't doing it for me. So, you know, I'm done with you and I'm moving on. And I think that's why I talked to Sam. Now, okay, let's turn the tables here and let's look at the church and let's have the church do its own confession. Why has the church been so impotent with this group? Those protected by quarantine don't usually develop antibodies, okay? Man, if you've lived in the church and if you've lived and been happy, and obviously many haven't and they've left the church, and we might argue that the church's program was, it's antiquated technology and it was built for other ages, but remember that the church is huge and the church is enormously diverse and the church always adapts to its tiny local culture. And this is why, even though now for 20 years we've had the technology to, and some churches have done this, to have your high status, excellent, high profile preacher beamed into a worship space, the majority practice within churches is a local pastor preaching. And, you know, Jonathan Peugeot talks about the fact that, okay, so at least if you have a historic liturgy that in a sense has been refined in Darwinian terms, has been refined and perfected throughout the ages, that's better than having your worship service be so dependent in a Protestant church on the 30-minute homily of the pastor. Because what if your pastor's a twit? Then your whole church, you know, is useless. But what's amazing is how many churches with pastors who are twits still do well and still survive and it still works for their people. Okay? So the church has actually adapted, and if you think about all of the ways, especially since the Protestant Reformation and the fragmentation of that church, the downside of fragmentation is the loss of unity. The upside of fragmentation is the achievement of specificity and contextuality in almost the amazing diversity of the world. And this is what we've seen missiologically, that the missionaries went over and the people would listen and that, well, this is crap. You know, the missionary preachers, Nobody wants to listen to them, but a national within their culture gets a hold of the Bible, and according to maybe someone with a Western pedigree in preaching, gets everything wrong, but he takes off like crazy. Why? Because it's the sinking of the stories. And that missionary couldn't connect well with the story on the ground. But boy, oh boy, once someone just had even a little bit of that Bible, even getting it wrong, off it goes. And this is what you see in the history of the spread of the church throughout the world, time and time again in the history of the church. And so, yeah, the church, even though it changes incredibly quickly, it never changes quite at the speed of culture. But it usually catches up. And again, it's usually the Protestants who wind up getting there first, or sometimes when things loop around, as we're seeing now, you know, the Orthodox and the Catholics are like, ah, look, welcome, come on in. But then again, as I was talking to, and I had my conversation with Luke. Many of you know Luke from Twitter that I talk with often. My conversation with Father David. I noted that Jonathan Peugeot, Father David, and Luke are all former evangelicals, and this is who's, see, this what I would bet is that these people coming around again to the Orthodox, they themselves will change the Orthodox Church, because they're on a different culture arc than, let's say, you know, those who are historically familial and for generations been up through that church. Now they find each other and they come together. I'm not gonna dismiss or depreciate that at all, but their Jonathan Peugeot's history as an evangelical and the journey he had to take himself informs the role he plays in the Jordan Peterson movement. All right. So some might have wandered out of this is Jordan Peterson. Some might have wandered out of the woods, but they couldn't blaze a trail. Jordan Peterson does blaze the trail, and that's why people follow him. You know, standard apologetics weren't relatable, and I've never found them to be relatable to me, partly because of my upbringing, I'm not really evangelical, even though I line up in terms of doctrinal check marks with evangelicals. But culturally, I've got this African-American stuff where I grew up, and I've got this Dutch Calvinism, and I'm just an odd duck. So, you know, a lot of the high-profile evangelical apologists, it just never got into them. C.S. Lewis, kind of like Peterson, blazed the trail because he walked through the journey. He grew up pre-World War I. He discarded his faith. He went through the war. He lived through the war. He had to face the nihilism, and he came out a Christian with all of what he had learned from the journey. Well, is there something new about this? Look at the Apostle Paul. Same thing. This is the path. Now we have the man from Alberta. He's easy to connect with in his folksy ways. And again, you look at Tim Lott. It's not hard to see why Jordan Peterson and Tim Lott, you know, Tim Lott's kind of this crusty journalist. And, you know, most journalists, at least the old school ones, you know, they work the streets, they work people, they get their way. Well, Peterson's got some of that attitude to him. Preaching has always been about mythology. And this is something that I picked up way before this, because I would watch these young earth creationists, and you can find them, they're not hard to find. And on one hand, they'll pound their Bible all day long. 6-day young earth creationism, and they'll have, you know, they'll make their point about that. But when they actually open the Bible on Sunday and teach, well, we're like Adam, we're like Eve. Now, in my tradition, we call this exemplarish, and in my preaching tradition, there was a big There was a big deal about emphasizing in our sermons, we continue to convey the redemptive historical approach to the gospel. And that's deep in the Dutch Calvinist tradition. But this exemplarishness, this, you know, finding assimilations, finding concordances between the story of Adam and Eve. Don't you feel like Adam? Don't you feel like Eve? What would you do if you were in the garden with the snake? What is it about Cain and Abel? Can you identify and relate with them? And so on this personal mythological, layer, listen to Joel Osteen. This is all he does. Okay? I mean, they pledge allegiance to the Bible, but any kind of what I would call serious tethering to the Bible gets lost, and all the Bible becomes then is a series of stories of examples of how you should have your best life now. So that's Joel Osteen's shtick. But my point here isn't that that's good, my or bad. My point is the form of it, that it's mythology. And what Peterson really did in the biblical lectures was he once again brought the Bible into the world of the new atheist crowd. He inverts all of these arguments from Sam Harris. Maybe not all of them, because, you know, you'd pull a string on the back of Sam Harris and he'd spit out for you the village atheist line. And this is what most of the village atheists do. But what Peterson does is he revivifies it. He's read so again, read the history of interpretation. I have this whole, and I brought this, and you've got all these fun colored books back here. Focus camera, there you go. But this series, the Ancient Christian Commentary on the Scripture, this is all snippets from the church fathers on how within their sermons they preached the texts. And I remember when I serendipitous, providential. Long before I got into any of this, I got a thing from IVP basically saying, you know, I joined the Commentary of the Month Club with this commentary, which I've never done with anything else, okay? And look at the church that's pictured on the front. I joined the Commentary of the Month basically with this, and this is the only commentary that I have the entire series of, all right? All these are all hand-picked, cherry-picked within my own particular framework, the best of commentaries out there that seem to align with what I found helpful. What I'd often find, and this is Jonathan Peugeot made a comment about this in Twitter once, what you'll often find, let's say with, let's grab a, okay, this is Kozelman. This is Kozelman on 1 Corinthians. And if you watch N.T. Wright's treatment of Bultmann, and then so many of these commentaries, so many of these critical commentaries that came about in the middle of the 20th century were absolutely unhelpful in finding out what the Bible might mean to a person in the pew. And that's what was behind Jonathan Peugeot's comment, okay? And you can very quickly see where a commentary series like this would feel way more helpful, but what you'll often find is a type of exegesis by the church fathers that is very pastoral, but also you have the polysemy, okay? You have the different levels of the scripture. And of course, that's baked into the Orthodox interpretations and their devotion to church fathers. Let me grab Mark, because I'm preaching in Mark right now. Okay, commentaries. Here's a really go-to commentary on the Gospel of Mark. It's actually a classic from an evangelical Protestant approach. And this is a classic commentary on the Gospel of Mark. And to me, it's a go-to commentary. It's a wonderful commentary. And as a practicing Christian, you can read this commentary and get things out of it. But that's different from, let's say, Here's another commentary on the Gospel of Mark, the NIV application commentary. And if you see a cover like this, you very quickly believe, okay, this is kind of for a popular audience. And the structure of the commentary always has, let's see, they have, if you look at a passage, they have the bridging contexts. So see, now we're aware of the differences. We're aware of the gaps that we're trying to deal with. So you have your bridging context, and then you have your contemporary significant. And that's a function of this series of commentaries, because series of commentaries always have their own pitches. C.E.B. Cranfield, here is a this Cambridge commentary series. Here is a kind of a classical mid-20th century approach to the text. This one is obviously more technical. It's for people who can manage Greek. But then you've got part of the reason I, even long before the Jordan Peterson, I mean, this is 15, 18 years ago that I was getting these, because I noticed that in many of the technical commentaries, there's very little pastoral, there was very little that was in them that was really pastorally helpful. Now, if I look at the text, I'm going to do rough draft for Sunday pretty quick here after I finish this video, if I don't eat up all my time talking too much. But I'm preaching on healing of the man with the withered hand. And so they have an overview. The intent of Christ's detractors was to discredit him, of course. They had interest. Okay, let's just go with Athanasius. In the synagogue of the Jews was a man who had a withered hand. If he was withered in his hand, the ones who stood by were withered in their minds. And see, so for the church fathers, they're very much church leaders. They spoke to people who were trying to live within the story and navigate the story. And they were looking at the crippled man, and they were not looking at the crippled man, nor were they expecting the miraculous deeds of the one who was about to work. But before doing the work, the Savior plowed up their minds with words. For knowing the evil of the mind and its bitter depth, he first softened them in advance with words, so as to tame the wilderness of their understanding, asking, is it permitted to do good on the Sabbath or to do evil, to save a life or to destroy one? And again, this comes from his homilies. And you'll find moves made by church fathers that you won't find made by contemporary commentators, because there's a world of difference between them, and they're dealing with the text differently. But again, my point here in this slide is that local preachers always go to the mythological, because it's the relationship with the stories that is helping people work out their stuff. And those who continue to go to church and those who find church helpful, whether through the liturgy or the homilies or the sermons, it's because somehow their world has been put together at church. That's what's happening. So the polysemy excitement that happened with Jordan Peterson. Why seminary education is a negative indicator of church growth. I came back to North America towards the end of the Seeker Church movement, which is an evangelical Protestant movement. And one of the things that really annoyed seminaries was that in study after study, they determined that a seminary education was a negative indicator of church growth. In other words, the more educated the pastor, the less able the pastor was to grow his church large. And you may say, well, why would that be? Especially for this crowd of you all who really like education, because you're sitting through my video, you would say, I really appreciate a pastor with a good, thorough education, a knowledge of Greek and Hebrew and systematic theology and philosophy and psychology, a broad liberal arts education. Well, that's the Jordan Peterson selective. Often what preachers who haven't had a seminary education, their sermons will major in the mythological and the symbolic, often at for someone who is classically trained in trying to discern a specific meaning of a text, their mythological interpretation will come at the expense of what the historical grammatical approach says the text is about. Now, I could do an entire video on that, but behind that is a whole history of philosophy about language and the Bible and meaning, all right? And the uneducated pastor doesn't care. He just finds that telling this story in this way makes people excited, just like Jordan Peterson says, when I start talking about responsibility, they get quiet. Well, these preachers, and the same is at least as true for preachers in the developing world that are making the missionaries look impotent, because they know their culture and they're naturally learning. When I talk this way and when I tell this story and when I give this illustration and when I make this point, everybody shuts up and they listen. Well, now you've hit a sweet spot. Now, did they get that point from the Bible? Maybe, maybe not. And this is when we get into this talk about the analogy of faith, which is kind of a broad way of talking about the general meaning of Scripture. And in the Christian Reformed Church in the mid-20th century, most of the sermons were not exegetically great. In fact, when I looked at the library that my father had of, let's say, biblical commentaries, there weren't many and they weren't good. But what mostly happened in Christian Reformed sermons was that they preached systematic theology through every sermon, and every text was just a jumping off point for their systematic theology. I came along later in the 20th century and biblical theology was reaching its supremacy, and so now churches talk about the Bible, or now churches talk about, well, what does the text say? And so the focus was on that. So you had John Stott's Between Two Worlds, The Art of Preaching in the 20th Century. But if you go to a mainline church, if you follow the sermons of my friend John Sook, who is now a former CRC pastor, now a mainline pastor in the United Church of Canada, pastors a church in in Toronto, Canada. If you look at John Sook and you look at what he preaches, well, he'll take a story, he'll take a movie, he'll take anything, and then he'll draw what's generally a social justice sermon from the context, because that has become the good news. All right, what's Peterson doing? Well, Peterson, what does he say that he does in the biblical series? It's a psychological approach to the Bible. And so what Peterson is doing is taking the stories in which he lives and trying to connect those stories in a way that eliminates depression and yields meaning. Now, he doesn't have a token at the end of his... See, if he really wanted to make the book tour better for everyone, he would need to include song and he would need to have a physical sacrament. That's how you'd turn it into a real religious assembly. The problem with the atheists in their Sunday assembly is they don't know enough psychology, which is ironic. Now, Peterson's Darwinian approach to text has a point. The Bible keeps hanging around. It keeps getting reworked from postmoderns to jungle tribes and loincloths. And that's Peterson's point about the Darwin. You can't make up a fairy tale. It keeps coming around. And Jordan Peterson's approach picks up on this. Now here's a funny thing, that there are multiple, when we talk about the Bible as the Word of God, there are multiple ways in which that is used within the Bible and within the church. At one point, it's what God says through the prophets, hear the word of the Lord. You get into Ezekiel, and a lot of it's almost performance art. But it's the truth, that which God speaks. And it's also Jesus, and it's also the Bible. And that's the Logos. And now we begin to see the Bible. So here's the question. Is Jordan Peterson colonizing the Bible, or has the Bible colonized Jordan Peterson? And through Jordan Peterson, is the Bible colonizing you? Much to Sam Harris's dismay, as y'all are stepping over him. Let's play some of this God number one and God number two, because I think in the process of the 20th century, we can understand why this is shaking out the way it is now. So it's been a few months since I've played this. I've listened to this a lot, and part of the subcommittees of my Consciousness Congress have continued to chew on it. And when I bump into something that connects with it, up it comes and says, hey, don't forget. So often I just refer to it, but I want to play some of it because I started talking about God number one and God number two. And that came up as I was listening to this part of Peterson. Peterson, I would say, is bringing back God number one. There's a reason God number one receded and God number two took the forefront. And most of who, if you listen to Sam Harris or Amun-Ra, most of the string pulls on the back of the celebrity atheists and their village atheist arguments are arguing against God number two. And Peterson starts to get around them by bringing Darwin up and showing God number one. And again, as I talk to people who have, they'd say, boy, once Peterson started talking about the creation of consciousness in the Garden of Eden and the snake and colors and patterns, well, suddenly God number one was there.
In what sense do you mean, what is the God that you act as though he, she, it exists? And what is the God-shaped thing I must have in my life to prevent me from being a, quote, real atheist?
See, and Peterson keeps, the Dillahunty talk was a warm-up for this one, because Peterson keeps saying, you atheists aren't really atheists. And that, boy, that annoys them. And so here's Sam Harris. Okay, Jordan, tell it to me straight. Who is this God that you act as if exists? And who is this God that makes my profession of atheism cheap and shallow?
Well, okay, first of all, I have to point out that there's no possible way I can answer both those questions in 2 minutes.
Well, it's the same question. But, I mean, yeah, what is okay. What do you mean by God?
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you some of the things that I mean by God. Okay.
Uh-oh. We do have to get the question.
Maybe we're going
to
do this tomorrow.
Yeah, maybe this is where we start. Oh, God. Well, that was a pretty resounding no.
It seems like that constitutes an audience question, wouldn't you say?
All right. I tell you what. Let's... let's do this, but let's be deliberate about time.
Okay. Well, I'm going to read some things that I wrote because it's so complicated that I'm not sure that I can just spin it off.
And Owen Benjamin would just be going nuts at this point.
The top of my head, and so you'll have to excuse me. So, and what I'm going to do is sort of paint a picture by highlighting different things. So now I already made one point here. I made the point that part of the conception of God that underlies the Western ethos is the notion that whatever God is expressed in the truthful speech that rectifies pathological hierarchies. And that isn't all it does. It also...
Okay, so now God number one is built into the world and built into our culture and built into our biology. In a sense, in him we live and move and have our being.
Confronts the chaos of being itself and generates habitable order. That's the metaphysical proposition. And that's best conceptualized as at least one element of God. And so I would think about it as a transcendent reality that's only observable across the longest of time frames, the longest of iterated time frames, to your point. So here's some propositions, and they're complicated. And they need to be unpacked, so I'm just going to read them, and that'll have to do for the time being. So, God is how we imaginatively and collectively represent the existence and action of consciousness across time. As the most real aspects of existence manifest themselves across the longest of time frames, but are not necessarily apprehensible as objects in the here and now. So what that means in some sense is that you have conceptions of reality built into your biological and metaphysical structure that are a consequence of processes of evolution that occurred over unbelievably vast expanses of time and that structure your perception of reality in ways that it wouldn't be structured if you only lived for the amount of time that you're going to live. And that's also part of the problem of deriving values from facts, because you're evanescent and you can't derive the right values from the facts that portray themselves to you in your lifespan.
That's Tim Lott's I-We.
Which is why you have a biological structure that's like 3.5 billion years old. So God is that which eternally dies and is reborn in the pursuit of higher being and truth. That's a fundamental element of hero mythology. God is the highest value in the hierarchy of values. That's another way of looking at it. God is what calls and what responds in the eternal call to adventure. God is the voice of conscience. God is the source of judgment and mercy and guilt. God is the future to which we make sacrifices and something akin to the transcendental repository of reputation. Here's a cool one if you're an evolutionary biologist. God is that which selects among men in the eternal hierarchy of men. So,
you know, Sam Harris's God is Mike up, because he's not happy with this.
You know, men arrange themselves into hierarchies and then men rise in the hierarchy. And there's principles that are important that determine the probability of their rise. And those principles aren't tyrannical power. They're something like the ability to articulate truth and the ability to be competent and the ability to make appropriate moral judgments. And if you can do that in a given situation, then all the other men will vote you up the hierarchy, so to speak, and that will radically increase your reproductive fitness. And the operation of that process across long expanses of time looks to me like it's codified in something like the notion of God the Father. It's also the same thing that makes men attractive to women. Because women peel off the top of the male hierarchy, and the question is, what should be at the top of the hierarchy? And the answer right now is tyranny as part of the patriarchy, but the real answer is something more like the ability to use truthful speech in the service of, let's say, well-being. And so that's something that operates across tremendous expanses of time, and it plays a role in the selection for survival itself, which makes it a fundamental reality.
Jordan, if I...
Okay, now Sam's going to interrupt, and we're going to play that, but... The God that most atheists complain about is a man in the sky. And what Jordan Peterson does here with God number one is much more say, in him we live and move and have our being. God is, well, he's represented in our imagination as a man in the sky, which is, quite frankly, in violation of the Ten Commandments, where God says, do not represent me as anything from within my creation. Why? Because he is his glory. Now, listen to me carefully. His glory is in everything that's in his creation. And you cannot, if you're going to represent him. Now, the Jews were even reticent about using a name to represent him, even though God gave them his name. But the reason that he should not be represented by anything within the creation is because his glory is manifest in everything in the creation. And if you listen to part of the video I played yesterday of Peterson at Cambridge, and they're talking about the God is accessible through every instance, all individuality. God is available. Someone mentioned in the comment section, they have the same cell phone holder. God's glory, and see now we're being careful with language, intentionally so, and I'm not saying God is in the cell phone holder. God's glory is manifest through the cell phone holder. And see, what I'm doing with that is hedging pantheism. God isn't in the cell phone holder. That's a problem of language, because then, oh, now, hey, look, yeah, whoop, I'm juggling God. No, it doesn't work that way. His something about God is, God is accessible even through the coldness of the steel and the strength of the steel and the cleverness. Now, when I was watching Vervaeke's newest video today, and I was watching a really important talk by David Bentley Hart, and hopefully I get time next week to make some videos about that. But God's glory is seen through the cell phone holder. He is available everywhere. Okay, but this is God number one, and in terms of our mental pictures, both for now, let's give the atheists some credit here, because the God they are critiquing is the God they hear the Christians talking about, which is mostly God number two. But now again, with my God number one and God number two, I'm not saying there are two gods. These are aspects of the same God, but they are distinct aspects in a way, and I'm pulling them apart because they have been pulled apart, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries by virtue of the history of culture in the West in those times. Okay, so you've got God number one and God number two. Sam Harris is complaining about God number two. Peterson is talking about God number one. And because of how God number one has been taken off the stage, which I'll talk about after I finish playing these clips from this talk, that is why God has become unreal and God has been reduced to the violation of the Ten Commandments, which is a guy in the sky. All right? And this is part of why I remain an iconoclastic Protestant. Well, that's going to get a bunch of comments. And again, I've said before, if you look at the Hebrew temple, it's full of images, just not one of God. You have the cherubim and the seraphim over the Ark of the Covenant, but the cherubim and the seraphim are not God, and they're not to be worshipped. And when they make a golden calf, well, that's a big no-no. And the sanction is pretty severe. What's behind the impulse of making the golden calf? It's the diminishment and destruction of God number one. All right? And so what Peterson has just laid out are just a few aspects of God number one. And if you let Peterson go, he'd continue to make that list. And you find most of what Peterson does is talk about God number one. And I would argue that, in fact, just within Protestant intramurals, the rise in young, restless, and reformed Calvinism, I think, has been because a fair amount of the Old Testament-ish God number one tends to be more strongly expressed in Calvinism than in a bunch of more recent happy-clappy evangelicalism. All right? I'm going to get some comments on that too. But my point here is that Peterson is reinvigorating, re-putting out God number one, and his audience is finding it compelling and finding it important for being able to regulate and manage the internal and external stories. Oh, and I thought this was going to be a short video.
Can I just cut in here with one question?
Stop with that for now.
What?
But he can go more.
So I was not hearing in that list of attributes a God who could care if anyone masturbated.
Okay. Now, Sam Harris's are going to focus on personal relational issues. All right? God number one is all the baked-in stuff. God number two is going to focus on the conscious relationship, and for that the guy in the sky is, and in some ways especially Jesus, but the guy in the sky really takes precedent. That's God number two.
I was not hearing a God who
depends on what else is stopping you from doing, Sam.
I missed that.
It depends on what else it's stopping you from doing.
Well, okay, so it's important to do something other than masturbate.
Yes. Yes, which actually constitutes a problem for many people.
Which is harder than it sounds.
Yeah.
I'm not hearing a God, a personal God, who can possibly hear anyone's prayers, much less answer them.
Right. God number two.
Right. And I'm wondering what percentage of religious people who would say, oh, yeah, I believe in God and it's the most important thing in my life. What percentage of those religious people do you think have in mind a God of the sort you just described?
Now, Sam's question isn't a bad one, because he's asking what percentage of people have a living sense of God number one. Well, what's happened in the West is the entire story since Darwin has been taking God number one out of the picture and making God number one recede and having God number one go away. That's the God of history. That's the God of rocks and trees. That's the God of biology. That's the God of science. And we've been pushing that stuff out of the Bible, except, of course, for this creation science camp that basically doubled down. So God number one is being pushed out, and what remains is God number two. And by the time you get to New Atheism in 2001, the God number two that they're protesting, not just in Christianity, but especially Islam, hence the connection to 9/11, but that then is Sam Harris's question about God. And what Sam Harris is about to ask reveals his ignorance.
I don't know, Sam. It's a good question, because when I go talk to people, when I talk to people online and use exactly this terminology, millions of people listen. So it's not so obvious what percentage of people see it this way. It may be that they have the intuitions, but they haven't been articulated well.
And that's exactly right.
This is the problem. This is what worries me about this. So, you could do the same thing with the idea of ghosts, right? So people traditionally have believed in ghosts. It's an archetype, you might say.
But here's the irony, that traditionally God number one was actually the God that they were talking about when the tsunami comes and wipes out. It's only, and you know that this change has happened, because suddenly when there's a tsunami, many evangelical and Christian leaders around the world jump up and say, that wasn't God. It wasn't God number two, but it was God number one. Well, now we get into the question of the fall of creation, so on and so forth. So, you know, so hold off on the comments about that. I appreciate those arguments and the fall of creation and sin brought into the world. I get all that. But it's when the Apostle Paul writes about the God that everybody knows about in the book of Romans, it's God number one. Jesus comes and you have God number two. You also have God number two in the Old Testament too, because Israel is relating to God in a very interpersonal, direct way. And that God number two isn't outside of paganism. Look at the stele of Hammurabi receiving the code from his God. Okay? So there's always been God number one and God number two. But God number one has been a very big deal throughout most of human history. And traditionally, that is God much more than the God that Sam Harris is complaining about.
Ghost, survival of death is certainly an archetype. And we know what most people most of the time mean when they say they believe in ghosts. And I say, I don't believe in ghosts. And you say, no, you do believe in ghosts.
That's not at all what Peterson is saying.
Ghosts are your relationship to the unseen. That's a ghost. So you have a new definition of ghost that you're putting in the place provided, which I have to say, well, of course I have a relationship to the unseen, so I guess I do believe in ghosts. You know, you win that argument. But
in a sense here, God number one has been so driven out already. If you're going to fully get rid of God, you're going to have to go to war against God number two. And that's exactly what the celebrity atheists have done. And that's exactly why they focus on God number two.
That simply isn't what most people mean by a ghost. Most
people
mean...
Yeah, but you can't use that simplified argument about my conception of ghosts as an analogy for the propositions that I just put forward.
This is what I see you do. I mean, maybe you have more to say on the topic of God, but this is what I hear you doing with God. You have defined the God that most people believe in, and we know this is the God that most people believe in.
I was asked what God I believed in.
Yes, no, but I'm asking you what percentage... Yes, but... You by shifting the definition, you have robbed the noun, the traditional noun, of its traditional meaning, and you're imparting to people.
Wait a second.
I'm not so sure.
What do you
sure
mean
of this.
By traditional meaning? Look.
And actually, I wish Peterson. Well, he doesn't talk in terms of God number one and God number two. But traditionally, Peterson turned and say, "Hey, wait a minute. Traditionally, that's not the God that Sam Harris is talking about at all. Traditionally, cross-culturally, in terms of later is going to go into the whole Hindu thing, God number one is all over the place. Now, there's always aspects of relationality that are in there, but what's focused on is God number one. And that's exactly what Peterson is bringing up with the use of Darwin.
It's one of the elemental claims in the Old Testament is that you're not even supposed to utter the name of God, because by defining it too tightly, you lose its essence. And so let's not be talking about what the classical definition of God is here, okay? It's a historical non-starter.
Okay,
and there's plenty of religions
on.
That
can
make
I, can
it...
Can I check in with the audience?
Okay.
So, yeah, that it is at the expense of Q&A. Okay. That's what you... Let me say, Sam... I do not believe in a supernatural God, but the God that I heard Jordan just describe, I do not have any difficulty understanding why he might care if you masturbate, and I also don't have any trouble figuring out how he might answer prayers.
Well, tell me more then.
Well, I can tell you how a prayer might be answered.
Okay, but these are...
Well, it's specific, so you could let me do that.
It'll be interesting. So I'm not Jordan. We've not talked about this. If I heard an answer from him that actually would satisfy me as to what the mechanism of action might be, that'd be pretty interesting. And if he can tell me what I heard... I think it would suggest that we're not just making up stories here.
Okay, so you might like this, maybe not, but it's possible. Okay, so let's imagine that hellish situation that you laid out. Okay, but let's put the extra twist in it, because one of the things that we both decided, I think, was that you also have to build in the intent into that. So let's say the hell that we're talking about isn't the victim of the terrible massacres that you laid out in the jungle story, but a perpetrator. Okay, so someone who's actually acted in a malevolent manner, truly malevolent manner. Okay, or maybe perhaps we wouldn't have to take that extreme case. We could say, well, perhaps you've decided that, any of you, you've decided that you've seriously done something wrong. Okay, and that you want to get away from hell. You want to make things better. Okay, so here's an exercise you can try. So what you do is you sit on the edge of your bed and you say, okay, what I did was wrong. And you have to really believe this, right? So you've thought about it.
It's funny that he uses the word believe in this context.
It's killing you. So now you're penitent and you're confessing, let's say. And you're confessing to yourself as much as to anyone. And you say, I really want to know what I did wrong. And I really want to know what I could do to put it right, and I'm willing to accept any answer that will manifest itself to me. Try that. See what happens. That's a prayer that will be answered, and it won't be answered in the way that you want it to be answered. I can bloody well tell you that.
Okay, but that...
Now, with my talking with Adam about his objective morality, this is what we're going about against the grain of the universe, against the moral order, against the Tao.
Well, what are you communicating with when you do that?
That is something that is a process that I'm familiar with. It doesn't require any supernatural explanation. And
watch that word. Whenever you have someone pull out supernatural, they're enlightenment smuggling. That's what they're doing. They're smuggling the enlightenment in there, because what you've done is you have split the world in a certain way. in a way that basically defines out certain things that we don't want in there. And if you ask yourself, why don't we want those things in there? They have everything to do with our fears, because we really don't want, read Thomas Nagel, we really don't want a conscious agent above us that will have his way with us, that will do with us what he pleases. We are terrified of that.
It certainly doesn't require that we imagine that any of our books were dictated by the creator of the universe.
I didn't say that it required any supernatural interpretation, or that it required...
He's pulling the string on the back of the celebrity atheist. Just trot out these village atheist stories. Just line them up, Sam. That's what you're doing.
But my concern, I was asked to provide an instance of prayer that worked. And that's what I did. I didn't do anything other than that.
That's fully understandable in terms of human psychology. And
it's not understandable because we don't know where the answer comes from.
Well, we don't know where anything comes from.
That's true.
Yeah, okay, so.
That's true. And if we can admit that, we'll be healthier for it. Now, again, I talked about the fact of the emergence of God number two over God number one. And when? Well, it started. Now, these things are long processes. They happen over multiple generations. They happen over decades and even hundreds of years. They happen at different spaces, at different speeds, in different contexts, in different ways. But generally speaking, I think you can see it in the 20th century towards the end of the Cold War. And there are certain places that you can see it. And one of the clearest places to see it is, let's say, in this classic by Chuck Colson, Born Again. Now, Chuck Colson was famously one of Richard Hitch, he was known as Richard Nixon's hatchet man. Chuck Colson would go after the reputation of Nixon's political enemies. That's what he would do. He, like Jordan Peterson, was raised in a mainline church. The mainline church was the religious expression of recruiting God into the Cold War. Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was not a particularly religious man, although his mother was, you can read some of that story in David Brooks' The Road to Character. The steel of the religious devotion of Dwight Eisenhower's mother got into young Dwight. And that's what David Brooks writes beautifully about in The Road to Character. But the mainline church, in a sense, still had God number one, but the last scraps of God number one, as God number one was passing, as increasingly in the mainline church, think about Bultmann, you can't read God in history. The Bible won't tell you history. The Bible won't tell you science. The Bible won't tell you this and that and this and that. The Bible will only give you morals. And towards the end of the Cold War, that was starting to fragment. So, but as in Bultmann, there were huge sunk costs in Christianity. Just like you don't make up a fairy tale, you don't discard your entire axiomatic system all at once. Generation after generation, it has to be set aside and have things replace it. Otherwise, anxiety and depression reign. And so as a society, the anxiety you have over losing your gods is troublesome. And you can find this in the process. You can see some of this in Plato and Socrates, as in some ways they're dealing with similar things. So you have huge sunk costs into Christianity, just like you had huge sunk costs, Socrates and Plato. Socrates in particular, at least in Plato, had huge sunk costs in the gods. And so we find Plato's Republic, you know, Socrates is going down to the wharf to see the gods, to see the parade of the gods. They're still participating in the cultic practice of the city. Now what happens in the story of Chuck Colson and his conversion is the overwhelming power of God number two over God number one in Chuck Colson's life. Chuck Colson grew up going to church, and so you'll find that when Chuck Colson and many of his generation converts, and that's the language they use, Many in the church are offended. You've been going to church. You've been taking the sacrament. You believe in Jesus. You've been going through the motions of all this. And Chuck Colson says, but no. The penny never dropped. That's Tim Keller's language. That didn't go down to the depths of my heart. I need a personal relationship with Jesus. I need Jesus to be real to me. So God number one is continuing to go down. God number two expands to fill the vacuum. All right. Well, what do you expand it with? Well, some of what we expand it with, to give credit to the celebrity atheists, is projection. And this is where we'll tend to see a God who can't send down fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah. A God who can't flood the world. A God who can't allow the Babylonians to come and destroy the temple in Israel. A God who can't do the kinds of things that are not in keeping with our projection of nice up to God. And so Charles Colson, and it's a wonderful book, you know, new edition of 2 million copy bestseller. So big, big book. Chuck Colson was a big, big deal. And his conversion was a big, big deal in a lot of Christian camps. In fact, people who are lovers of Chuck Colson endowed the systematics chair at Calvin Seminary. That's the Chuck Colson chair of theology. And there's a lot of people on the CRC left that really drives them crazy. I remember this because, again, I lived through a lot of this stuff. I was young. But I remember, so I was thinking about this, I remember that song, and I had to do a little bit of Googling to find it. It was written by Ralph Carmichael, who was born in 1927. Chuck Colson was born in 1931, very much the same generation, my father's generation, okay? And I found this great YouTube of, it looks like something out of a nice 60s movie. You got all these young kids dressed up at the beach in Southern California, have a nightly cookout, and they're singing, "He's everything to me. In the stars his handiwork I see. On the wind he speaks with majesty." It's God number one. "Though he rules over land and sea." God number one. What is that to me? Need a personal relationship. I will celebrate nativity. The aspects of the historic Christian faith have not fully been moved aside yet. For it has a place in history. God number one is still there. Sure, he came to set his people free. What is that to me? Now we see the rise of Robert Bella expressive individualism. Okay, this is the big me. Again, you read about this in David Brooks' The Road to Character. "Till by faith I met him face to face." And then, that's how I remember the song well, sang it a lot. "And I felt the wonder of his grace." Notice all the emotional language coming in. "Then I knew that he was more than just a God who didn't care, that lived away out there, and now we're singing love songs to Jesus. Now he walks beside me day by day, ever watching o'er me lest I stray, helping me to find a narrow way. He's everything to me." Love songs to Jesus, basically. Now, what has been happening in the great walking away from the church? Now, according to Amun-Ra, what religious people do is hunt down and kill those who defect. Given the number of nuns that have walked away, N-O-N-E-S, who have walked away from the church here in America, how is the government covering up Paul Vanderclay being an assassin to everyone who leaves Livingstone's church? You know, I'm keeping them in the church because I tell them, yeah, you miss a Sunday, boy, and I'll get in there at night, and first I'll threaten your dog, then I'll threaten your kids, then I'll take your life. That's what religious people do. You've been watching too much TV, dude. Has that ever happened in religious communities? Absolutely. Do you find that happening in American Christianity or even American Islam? I'm not saying there isn't social pressure. But hunting people down and killing them? And this is a guy who says, I only believe what's on facts. Well, baby, you're going to have to show me some facts to back that sucker up. Anyway, why have many people, well, I can't believe in God because of the hard things that happened in my childhood, because of the pain in my life. Well, a lot of that is God number one. And when God number two grows so large and the me grows so large, again, read David Brooks' The Road to Character, me gets so big, well, I can't believe in God. Then you get into Christian Smith's long, do I have the book here? I usually post the book. Christian Smith's, do I have it on the sociology section over there? See, this is how my office gets messy. I pull books off the shelf and then I don't clean it. Christian Smith's Soul Searching, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers. And he's a sociologist and he went through interviewing American teenagers about what they really believed. And what he came up with was moralistic therapeutic deism that basically said, God is a divine butler who answers wishes and helps me give me meaning in my life and makes me feel good about myself. And this is exactly the God that the celebrity atheists are attacking. But the God in the spiritual imagination of American teenagers is not the God of the Bible. And that's why people read the Bible and like, I just can't believe in a God that would drown the world. And well, then some people say, well, I can't believe in a God that would allow environmental devastation or nuclear war or. Add another book to the pile. He's everything to me. Now again, in Christianity, it's God number one and God number two. It's both and. But if God number one is going away and God number two fills the vacuum, your picture of God is going to be imbalanced. Well, how do you balance your picture of God? The Bible. Jordan Peterson does is revivify God number one. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. God is not simply the sum of all, which is pantheism. The whole earth is full of his glory. This is a sacramental view of reality. And again, for Jordan Peterson, meaning is the sacrament. Now, that then helps you understand what and why Jordan Peterson is doing. Scratch beneath the interface, and there he is, God number one. It's exactly what Jordan Peterson was saying. God number one, to our surprise and horror. So, all the way back to the beginning, meaning and depression. Well, meaning is his sacrament. Tim Lott nails it right there in that video. He basically says it. You know, I listened to Jordan Peterson and it changed me. He's saying, Paul, what do you have any evidence about this depression thing? Yeah, look at Tim Lott. Look at that interview. I didn't even do it. But one of the viewers watched it and said, yeah, that's what you're talking about. And a lot of them have said, yeah, that's my story. And it's about the crisis and anxiety. Now, ironically, the antidote to the crisis and anxiety is God number one, the scary God. Because, well, here's the thing. Suppose there isn't a scary God. Well, we prefer that the universe be governed by chaos. The only reason you prefer chaos is because there's something even scarier than chaos out there. And that's an intentional will able to oppose you. So you've really got three levels. You've got an intentional will that is in fact in your favor. Well, that's the best of all. And then there's chaos and an intentional will that opposes you. So now you ask, well, which position is motivated? Again and again, I hear people saying, well, you know, Christians just believe in projecting a sky daddy who can take care of them. Yeah. And maybe the reason that you've undercut your gods is because the thought of there being a conscious agent that you're not able to manipulate or control, who, for his own reasons, can take you out, yeah, you'd better be scared about that. And in fact, we engineer an entire political system so that the government not be tyrannical. Because in many ways, Uncle Sam, if Uncle Sam becomes a tyrant, well, we're all in trouble. Well, we're small creatures. So I hope this helps. I didn't intend for this to be a long video, but it happens. So I've got to do rough draft for Sunday yet. So thanks for listening.